Lainey Taylor is a New York Times and Sunday Times bestselling author of Daughter in Smoke and Bone trilogy and The Strange the Dreamer duology, among other books. She's been translated into more than 30 languages, shortlisted for the National Book Award, and won a Prince Honor. You can find more about her writing, as well as a warm and active community of writers at all stages, at her Patreon and Discord, where she meets with members on Zoom every week. Hello, readers. This episode is brought to you by the Lainey Taylor Daughter of Smoke and Bone Special Edition. This special edition set includes all three books from the Daughter of Smoke and Bone series. There is a custom signature page signed by Lainey. There's breathtaking covers that do match our Strange the Dreamer box set that sold out, 10 Tippin art pages, plus there's a vellum overlay, which is really beautiful and kind of alludes to a specific part of the plot of the story. There's 6 location end paper illustrations, so the end pages are beautiful, fully illustrated, handwritten annotations, of course, by Lainey in the margins of all three books, and it has a illustrated slipcase with foiling details and gilded page edges. So all in all, this is a very beautiful special edition set that we are so excited to feature today. I believe there are still some Daughter of Smoke and Bone box sets in the shop, and this box set comes with beautiful gilded edges. So it truly is a very special edition, LaChoice special edition, and it is in our shop for a limited time. To purchase this box set, you can head to literarycrate.com/Lainey. That's /LAINI. Okay, so let's kind of jump in. We have so many questions for you, but it's just so lovely to chat with you. So really, yes, it's kind of just, we'll chat for like an hour and what we get to, we'll get to. And otherwise, we'll just, you know, I'm sure it'll be a lovely conversation. So I think kind of on the subject of writing, when did you kind of know you wanted to be a writer? Was it always a part of you? Was there a moment? So I want to know kind of about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I've always, I always loved books so much as a kid. And as far as long as I can remember, that was, that was what I wanted to do. And there, you know, how it is over time, this is sort of like a mythologized moment. And the only time I really clearly remember is, you know, as a little kid, is like, you know, sitting on the porch writing a story of like a fairy tale that was, it had a talking crawfish in it. That's all I remember.
Amazing.
But,
but
yeah, it's just always been the thing. There are other things came and went, but writing was always, you know, that dream as well. Except, you know, it took me a really long time to actually seriously do the writing part of that, of the writing, being a writer in any serious way. Yeah.
So tell me, what was like your first published work and like the story behind that?
You mean my first like published book, like my first, you know, I guess.
Well, yeah.
Well, I after college, you know, and it was the time came to get serious about writing. I was, working at a computer all day, which was, you know, made it not fun to come home and like be on a computer, or not that you have to. I wasn't writing. And that wasn't the real reason. I think the real reason I like later sort of figured out is that, I didn't know what to write about. Like I had, you know, all the things that I'd loved that had made me a reader had been sort of like whipped out of me in university, I guess. And so when I tried to write, it was like I was trying to be some other writer. I didn't really have the material to write literary fiction so I wasn't writing. And then there was all the other issues. So I started doing art. And so my first published works were actually illustrations. And that was, you know, in the years after college, I fell in love with children's picture books. And so I started working on learning how to be an artist because I figured, that'll be easier than writing. And and it turned out like in a weird, weird, circuitous way, it like delivered me back to writing with a little bit of student debt from art school acquired along the way and a husband. So,
well, yes. There you go.
And then, you know, it also gave me a lot of sort of like creative tools mentally to get through projects and to tackle writing in a new way. The same way that I'd had to learn how to finish illustrations, but that was like much more visible and tangible, you know, like when you're working on writing, it's a lot easier to kind of deceive yourself or delude yourself that you're making progress. But maybe that's just me.
No, I think that, I mean, in the same way that like how do you know when an illustration is done? And like, how do you know when a story is done? How do you know when the thing you created is done?
But also for me, it was like with my perfectionism, it was like this constant rewriting. And when like, I kind of jokingly say that like in The Shining, if Jack had been a painter, like his wife would have caught on a lot sooner, right? He wasn't actually, you know, with a writer, you know, if you're rewriting the same chapter over and over, who's going to know?
Totally.
And so I did have this, like, I had bad habits of just, you know, when it got hard, I would switch to something else and sort of rewrite it. And then I was going back and forth between projects. And it was just, I wasn't like, I think I deceived myself about it for a really long time. And then I started going to writing conferences and being surrounded by people who were actually finishing manuscripts and selling them. And it was so like inspiring, but also sort of like shaming, like, surely I can do that. And it really, getting out there into that world of people in, you know, physically going to conferences, like was a huge, it finally like made me really look at what I was and wasn't doing. So.
Oh, totally. That makes sense. What about your writing process now? Now, what tools have you developed or kind of maybe tell us behind the scenes of when you have a new idea, how do you bring that to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a lot about this in the last few years. I mean, I've been writing a lot about writing and process because I started a Patreon a few years ago. And you know, writing about it is, it's really interesting. It has made me kind of look at it and look at, you know, when I describe my process, like, that's insane. Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone do it that way? There's so much better ways to do this. And yet, you know, we have the brains we have and do it the only way that we, you know, that we're able to do it. And I try to know as much as I can about the idea up front. And it feels like, you know, this time I'm going to outline it. This time I'm going to know. I'm going to figure it all out up front so that I'm not, you know, blundering forth into the unknown and have to rewrite it a million times or, you know, taking wrong turns. And yet, like every time that I have done that, I still do the exact same thing where I, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's because I had, you know, the scenes that I had imagined when I get to them, like they're not right. But the main thing is that I'm not able to, the kind of books that I want to write, like I can't see them fully from the beginning. I can generally have a sense of the ending, but all the things I'm sort of, I guess with the few books, you know, the books that I have written, I discovered along the way that by writing the way, you know, writing this process of not totally knowing where I'm going or, you know, that I was looking for the elements that would fit together and make it bigger than the sum of its parts. I was looking for something that I didn't know yet. And until that happens, I'm not satisfied. And so no matter what I can figure out up front, it's almost like self-defeating because if I figure it out up front, then I guess the thing is that I'm trying to write the books that fulfill me are ones that I don't know exactly what's going to happen up front. And so it's the process of discovering that and those pieces that fall into place late in the game that just, you know, are dazzling and that I realize where I was headed all along, even though I didn't know it. And those sort of like exciting things are the payoff for in some cases, years of terror.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I feel like that's where a lot of the magic lives, right? As an author, is in the thing you don't know. And it sounds like you are a pantser a little bit in the world of writing. We talk about plotters and pantsers, and you're both probably. But that the magic lives in just being like, where is this character going to take me? Where's the story going to take me? And
but I'm like a reluctant pantser. Like, I want to know. Yeah. Like, I would be so, like, if there's a part of me that thinks I would be so happy if I just knew exactly what happened in the scene and I got to, like, just sit down and write it. And that, but when that is the thing that's happening, then it doesn't hold my interest is what happens. I have to then tear it apart and come up with something new that will. And, you know, this might just be ADHD. This might be like, I need fresh dopamine. I need something new to happen and not an issue with the story itself. And it might be that I'm asking a question I don't have an answer to yet. And the perfectionism, which is a sort of like unknowable quantity, like, is my brain lying to me? Or am I really not satisfied with this yet? Has this not gotten to where I need it to be yet? Or is it actually fine? And in a month, I'm going to be like, oh, that was fine. So there's a lot of components. But so process-wise, I think of, you know, I to really engage in a story, I generally have like a set of elements that are character, situation, questions, characters and what they want, set in an interesting world that I want to explore, and a sense of an ending. And then I have to, you know, along the way, I have a sense as I'm sort of gathering these pieces together that they're going to fit in a way that I can't see yet, and that it's going to be better than what I could come up with today, you know, if I force myself. And so then I just start sort of moving them in that direction and creating scenes in which the characters, you know, do things I didn't expect. That's what I'm always hoping for. I try to create like a process where everything is about sort of calibrated about trying to get in a flow state where the unconscious, you know, jumps in there and makes things happen that I didn't consciously predict, and that make me, you know, realize where it's going, that the some, you know, part of me. And so it's like trying to create those moments to move the story forward. And then if that doesn't happen, I'm just, you know, pushing it in that direction, and getting it there however I can.
Regarding scene, I love your book so much. And so I have my favorite scenes that are committed to memory. And I am curious in your writing process and those scenes and kind of pushing them along. Are there any of your scenes that stick out in your mind as the favorite to write? Like your favorite scene, or maybe a collection of a few scenes where you're like, that scene surprised me, or that one was my favorite, or something around that?
Yeah, I think the scenes, you know, certain scenes end up being memorable for different reasons, like in the sort of like, you know, progression of all these days of writing, the ones that stick with me often are the ones where, yeah, like my mind got blown by something I didn't consciously plan. And, you know, the end of Strange the Dreamer was like that in a major way. It was like, I was so tired and sort of on deadline and, you know, trying to get there. I was so close. And then something happened that made me realize I was completely wrong about a fundamental aspect of the book. You know, it didn't make me have to go back, but it was something that I had not seen consciously. And it, like, all of a sudden, it felt like I was like super hyper awake, and I started figuring out like, okay, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? Can I do this? Like, or am I just, is this crazy? And then it really, the climax, and everything that happened thereafter, everything that happened in Muse of Nightmares would not have happened if that had, you know. So it was just, and it's one of those things where I'm like, it's crazy that I didn't know this all along. But I love hearing about that when authors, you know, have a last minute sort of like realization. And it's so fundamental to the book that you could never tell that. You could never tell if they didn't say so.
Yeah.
But it feels kind of dippy in a way. Like, how did you not know this? But on the other hand,
I totally get it. Because we say that all the time.
Yeah.
We do such creative things at work and we're like, well, we didn't know that until we knew it. And you almost feel kind of silly that you didn't know the thing.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's just part of creativity is the uncertainty. It's like Ed Catmull says, you have to be able to sit in the shadow of uncertainty. And that's where like creative magic happens.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I totally get it.
It's very uncomfortable in the shadow of uncertainty.
I know. Oh, yeah. I think that's why it's courageous to be creative, is because there is like there's no guarantee.
Yeah.
And so you just have to keep trusting the process over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And
I feel like every author we've interviewed, they have a moment like just like you described, where we got an interview Holly Black and Cassie Cassandra Clare together, and they both had something similar, right? Mm-hmm. Where they mentioned like, we got to the end and I realized I had to change something and go back, you know, and affects the whole story. Or they got really close to something where they thought it was going to be the perfect ending or moment, and they took it to like a writing group and they were all like,
nope.
Redo. You know, and exactly like you're saying, it's part of the process. And and it just feels like it unfolds the way it's supposed to. Like it always just feels like,
or you know, you think along the way, you're like, why couldn't I not get the right idea like third or fourth or fifth, instead of like, you know, having gone through so many, you know, so many other ones first. But you know, you write to find the story. And some of them, sometimes it is there on the surface and it comes to you easily. And sometimes it just takes a lot more exploration and going deeper and deeper into the story. Like I think of it sometimes as like, you know, you're telling, you know, the narrative, the plot is going in this direction along the surface of things, but then so much else is going in this direction. It's like depth into the themes and into the stuff, you know, and it's not moving. It's not like giving you pages necessarily, but it's like just as important. And until those things are there, these sort of underpinnings, and until you've infused the book with them, like the characters aren't alive. They don't know what they want. They don't. And so the things don't happen. And so there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of going in that direction and just digging deeper into the story and trying things and letting your characters develop and talk and do things and seeing what happens.
Yeah. I'm like, whatever you're doing is obviously working. So I'm like, just keep doing that. You're clearly like an incredible author. We've been very vocal about how much we love your series, your books.
You guys are amazing. Thank you so much for
of course.
All the support for your beautiful editions.
Yes. We have gotten the privilege of getting to do both of your box sets. So we have Change the Dreamer. Oh, is it there?
Oh. Yes.
That's and then Daughter of Smoke and Bone.
Oh.
And, you know, it was interesting. Oh, how cute. We were interviewing Jay Kristoff a few weeks ago, and we were talking about some of our favorite. Oh, my gosh. Jay's a delight.
Yeah. Jay did play you a compliment. He said you are like one of the best in fantasy right now.
So we all agreed.
He's a babe.
Yeah.
Just to
pass that along. Yeah. We were like, yeah,
He's been such a great supportive writer friend, and he's so incredible. And I got to meet Jay and Amy together, actually, Amy Kaufman. The one time I ever got to go to Australia on book tour, and I was in, say it wrong, Melbourne, say it very Americanly. And got to meet them in person. And I'm so glad just over the years then, you know, just seeing both of their careers take off and blossom. They were, I don't know if they were published yet, if it was like coming out, but yeah, they're both such incredible authors, and just, I can't wait for, Empire of the Vampire Part 2.
I know.
Oh yeah.
And the editions you guys did edition last year was stunning.
Of Nevernight. Did you get a copy?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. I was like, we'll send you one.
No, it's incredible. It's so like, it just looks like something you would find in some like terrifying, you know, wizard library or something.
I know.
It's very Jay.
It's very him. I want to know to Jay's point, I'm like, we talk about your books every episode, it feels like, where we're like,
seriously.
And if you wanted to read any book, read this one. Because Strange the Dreamer, you and, you know, Jane and the publisher really took a chance on us. We had printed our own books that were classics because they're public domain, because we were like, I wanted to do special editions. I knew that back in like 2017. But I was like, we have to figure out how to print our own books. We have to figure out production. And so we just, we bootstrapped international production and finding the right print houses. And so I'm just like so grateful that you said yes, because it was really the thing we told other authors that we were like, we're very experienced because look, we did Lainey's book.
Well, and it was such a cool serendipity too. I think because Jane, my agent, her background is in licensing and big, product licensing, that she knew enough about, you know, what you guys were trying to do to feel comfortable with it in a way that maybe some agents would be like, oh, I don't know.
Totally.
That's true.
Yeah. No, it was like, I just got on the phone with Jane and I was like, I really feel like we can do this. And she's like, okay, well, like, let's make this happen, you know? And so it was just, it was a serendipitous moment that I think kind of changed the trajectory of Lit Joy in the direction that we were trying to go.
All book boxes were really
now,
right?
You know? I know. Now they all print their own special editions. And we're like, you're welcome, guys.
We'll pave the way.
It's so like really as an author, it's just the coolest thing to get to have. You know, we love getting new editions from a publisher or all of those. And it was always cool to get, you know, the old, what it would just be sprayed edges or a slightly different cover treatment or something. But like, this is so much better. And also I love, you know, just how many artists you get to try and give, you know, work to. And there's just so many cool things about it.
Well, thank you.
And huge thanks to crazy readers who will buy all the editions.
I know. They love it, but I totally get it. I'm like, to do a treatment, I think it was a little intimidating to launch with Strange the Dreamer and Muse of Nightmares because of how visceral and totally immersive your books are, and they are unlike any other writer. There is nothing that feels like reminiscent. Mm-hmm. It's just Strange the Dreamer is our number one fantasy whenever anyone asks us. And we can't, we haven't been able to top it. And so, I mean, it's just, you have to publish something else for us. But I'm just, I am curious, is there, or I guess not curious, I just want to say, like, probably for me, the scene that just sticks with me is Nora and Kova. Is it Kova? Nora and Kova on the beach. Like the very beginning of Muse of Nightmares. I just, that is one of the best scenes.
I love your scene so much. And I loved writing that scene. I was sort of conscious as I was doing it, like, this could be a book.
Yes.
And it was hard to really minimize. It didn't end up being hard because I could feel what was right for this book. And I have had that experience. And if you guys can think of any books off the top of your head where you love the first book and you start book two and it starts with a new character you don't know. And you're like, what the hell? Like, who is this?
Yes.
Where's, you know, where's Laszlo or whatever? And so I definitely didn't want to like go too far. I think of like the Subtle Knife, the Philip Pullman, I remember. And then also that, no, I guess it was different with like the second Outlander book. It wasn't that it was a different character. It was that like 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, crazy. Yes. And I just was like, what? So I was conscious of that and wanting to get back to my main characters quickly. But I loved writing their story. And then subsequently, when their chapters would come along, those were definitely some of my favorite to write, especially as things got worse and worse for Nova.
Yes.
Those are some of my favorite scenes I've written for sure.
Well, the treatment, well, in their chapters, it was one of the most creative ways to give context to a magic system, right? Because at no point during the book did I feel like, oh, this is her magic system. But in looking back on it, you're like, oh, okay. Like, it's just, it is. Like, you know, the people are blue because they are. And, you know, Laszlo is, you know, going on this journey because that's the way it's supposed to go. And then as these little things come up, you look back on it and you're like, that was just, there was no telling us, there was just showing us through the story. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that's where I just like fangirled so hard. Oh, I was like, I wanted to drop right into the Library of Zozma and just go with Laszlo, you know?
Well, thank you. And there was so much about it, like that, you know, I knew, you know, I thought about it a lot about the magic system up front. And I, you know, as far as there being blue, like I needed there to be a way that they couldn't pass, you know, as
yes. Yeah.
And that they knew of. And, yes. And so if it was going to be something as blatant as skin color, you know, it was like, what color would it be? And really that was really the only choice. You know, everything else is so coded to like demon or I don't yes. know. And then blue. It has that because it is the color of like, you know, divinity and like
yes.
Hinduism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then a lot of the things, you know, I did know, but it's one of those things where you like kind of, you know, something, but you don't know how it's going to fit later on. And you just go forward hoping that, you know, about you get the. And so many things in this book did fall into place in that way where I realized, oh my God, you know, as I yes. was going and big things like I didn't intentionally. At the beginning, you know, there were so many things. It was supposed to be one book. It was called Muse of Nightmares. And it was not connected to, you know, my other world in any way, like until as I was writing, you know, the idea of a multiverse came into it. And of course, I already had one of those. And so if that was, you know.
Like, why not?
I know. And so then once those started to come together, like so many things just. You know, I guess it really was for me a great example for myself to rely on, to think back on, to like trust, to just trust that future Lainey will figure it out.
Yes.
And then like yes. current me is like, damn you, past Lainey.
Uh-huh. I'm like, when did you, I've heard you talk a little bit about Laszlo and how it was originally just Sarai's story. So I would love to know when Laszlo kind of became clear to you that you're like, oh, there's a whole thing here.
Yeah. So he was going to be the love interest. And I did know to some extent what he was going to find out about himself. But he still, you know, wasn't I mean, I actually can't remember exactly when I knew that for sure. But I think I knew that at this point. But I was trying to, I had the idea of leading the reader into their first view of Weep through the eyes of an outsider. And so I was developing this outsider who was going to be the love interest. And as I got to know him, that sort of like kept getting like, I mean, is this sort of, I often end up doing these sort of like non-traditional structures, things that if you did outline your book up front, you'd be like, oh, that makes no sense. I'm not going to do that. And so all of the Laszlo stuff at the beginning is kind of like a really long prologue in a way before he gets to Weep, and a lot of the stuff with him and Thion. And so really there's a part of me that's like, this shouldn't be, you know, this kind of like the way in Daughter of Smoke and Bone, like the last third of the book almost is a, you know, there's a huge flashback at the end that if it was in an outline, you'd be like, no, don't do that. That's not the way you write book. But like the story couldn't be told any other way. And that was the case with this, where as I was exploring this character, he just kept evolving, and it became, I wanted to be there. And I realized, you know, at a certain point, and it was the point, you know, and I annotated this in the edition that, that a book of fairy tales, you know, fell his first day on the job. He got hit by a book of fairy tales, broke his nose. And so that he was literally formed by stories. And I just thought, oh my God, this is his book. Like, this is my, you know, this is, I have to explore his journey. Yeah. And that chapter was called Strange the Dreamer. And I just loved the setup so much that I knew he was going to lead us in. And so I emailed my editor, and she, I think they balked a little at the title Strange the Dreamer first. Cause I think it, you know, it does have that sort of like, if you don't know that it's just a name, it sounds a little bit like, abstract, almost strange, the dream, or poetic, or, you know, but I loved it. And they came around to that, and they definitely didn't balk at splitting it into two books. They were great about that.
Yeah.
Super supportive about all of it.
Yes.
So that was lovely.
Yeah. It started with Miracles for Breakfast. That's the book that hit him, isn't it?
Mm. I don't know if that was, because that was like a, it was like a big book. I don't know if that was specifically Miracles for Breakfast. That was the one that then, Miracles for Breakfast is the one he took to Thion. But I don't know if the book that hit him was ever named as, besides being a fairy tale.
Book of fairy tales.
actually, I was at, I maybe it was online or at a book event recently. I think it was when I did a signing recently. When I was interviewing another author who was visiting Portland, and a woman told me that her, Strange is her comfort read, and her toddler, her two-year-old, knew that, and she was like having a bad day, so he came running up to her with it. And I like to think that it was your very heavy edition,
like our hulky edition.
And he tripped and broke her nose with it.
Oh!
I'm not saying it was her edition. It was Strange to Dreamer, but like, it's horrible, but it's awesome.
It's also like, it is prophesied.
You're all, oh my gosh. Like, if that really happened, she didn't have a Laszlo visibly broken nose.
Goodness.
Luckily. And I'm going to believe that it happened because I love that story.
And that's amazing.
Oh my gosh.
What character would you want to meet in real life of all of your characters?
Oh, ones you've written.
Oh, yes, all out the of characters. All of my characters.
Let's do both. I mean, let's do one of yours and then outside of yours.
Okay. Well, that's going to be hard. But of all my characters, if I can, you know, not, it's like, I don't want their life. I will keep my own life. But Karu is definitely that wish fulfillment character. Like, she's an artist and she can fight, and she doesn't have to go to the hairdresser. Yes.
Which is amazing.
She speaks all the languages. She was like my wish list of like, oh, wouldn't it be amazing? You know, when I think it was like when I, you know, really finally commit, like, I think there had been years of sort of purging off like my literary phase, I guess, like literary pretensions of being an English major. And at a time, especially when I think it's in some places not as bad now, where you actually, you know, they read books that aren't by dead white men sometimes now. But as I was writing, and I started with middle grade fantasy, because, you know, I think I got turned on to that. Well, I don't think, I know that it was like when Harry Potter changed things, and I read those. And then that was like the gateway back into fantasy and books for young people. And so I was re-engaging in that way, but I had sort of missed YA as it, like, partly because of age, and partly because I was a total snob in high school. And so really, Daughter of Smoke and Men, I had written Lips Touch, which was short stories, which are solidly YA, but it's different. So like writing Daughter of Smoke and Men was really my first sort of like just full commitment to YA, and that this character was like this just a gift to my teenage self, who probably wouldn't have appreciated it because I was too busy reading French poetry or whatever. But if she could have, like, if nobody was looking, maybe, you know, 17-year-old Lainey would have enjoyed.
Yes. Absolutely. I love
that. Okay. What about a character from any other book you've read that's not of your
own? Hard.
I know it's a hard question.
I'm so bad at like pulling things. I mean, who has like really great powers, or I don't know. Do you guys have one?
Oh, that's a good question. We're like, yep, that was
good. I'm like, I have a couple. I'm like, I would probably high up on the list of interesting characters to meet. I don't know. It depends on how long I have to hang out with them. Like, I want to witness them, but I don't know. Definitely, like, Laszlo is on my list. I love Laszlo so much. I feel like I married a Laszlo.
I feel congratulations, like, by the way. I love seeing all your wedding stuff on your
thank
Instagram.
You. Yes. I know. He's the best. So I very much married, like, kind of the nose Laszlo librarian nerd.
I love
romantic.
That.
Very romantic. But, so no, I can't meet Laszlo. It feels like I've got a problem there. I also just think that some of Sarah's characters would be just like intense to witness, like Aelin Galathinius walking towards you. You'd be like, sure, I'll bow. Like, what do you need? Like, that's just like an intense and would be very like otherworldly experience.
Oh, yeah.
From the classics, probably Anne Shirley. If I had to pick a classic.
Oh, God, yes.
Anne Shirley.
Oh, my goodness. That would be so fun.
Yeah, and I just feel like I need to walk around my library to like come up with an answer. I'm just completely blanking. I'm so bad about that. Sorry.
Oh, no. I blanked too. The second you asked me, I was like, this was unfair. That wasn't a fair ask. But I do want to ask you more about Minya, because she's
such
an interesting character, and absolutely like already enjoyed the duology so much, but it like elevated it to like now you are on my favorites list forever.
Oh, thank you. Well, Minya is definitely it. Like a trust the process lesson to me, because I had no idea where that was going. I just, when I first thought of her, she just like, she was just this weird little kind of mean kid who didn't age. And I didn't consciously, like I really didn't think, even unconsciously, I didn't know why. She just didn't age. And as the story went on and I started to figure out, you know, who she was and why she was like that. And she really became like the emotional center of the book. And
yes. Yeah.
And in such a like a huge way. And I just felt like that was really, to me, because the question in Strange the Dreamer is like, is the only way to win by killing the enemy? And if that's the only way, then it can only ever end when, you know, everyone is dead. Right. And so I was really trying to think, you know, what if you can't, what if that is just not an option? Like, because that would just backfire in too many other ways. And it's like, if you can't kill the enemy, and if you have this antagonist that literally is your anchor to life yourself, like, and you wouldn't want to kill her and you can't kill her. Like, what do you do? Like, can you save somebody who is profoundly traumatized to save? Can somebody who's so profoundly traumatized be healed? And I want to believe yes. And so like as a writer, you know, you get to say, I'm going to really try. But there was always that feeling that like, maybe not, like maybe I can't. And then I think, you know, with another character in the book was a case of, no, sometimes you can't, like some people, sometimes you can't. So you can't save everyone. And, but Minya, I was really determined. And that was really sort of felt like my quest. At a certain point, like it really took over. But that was one of the things, like figuring out really what she was doing and the thing that people didn't know, that nobody knew. I didn't know about the Aelins when I started writing. Mm. Like I didn't know.
Fascinating.
What she was doing. Yeah. Yeah. So.
I don't know. It just all came together in a way. I remember because we'd put the first book, Strange to Dreamer, in one of our YA crates, right?
Yes.
And loved it. It was one of our best-selling crates we've ever done. And then I got an ARC for, you know, the second one for...
Yes, Muse of Nightmares.
And I remember reading it in my bed, and I finished it, and I was just like, oh my gosh. oh my gosh, this was the most incredible ending I've ever read in a book. I like told Alex immediately and I was like, you have to read it.
Then I read the arc.
And I just sat in bed all day and read, I remember, and just being like, my mind was like blown. And that's how we describe it a lot when we are talking about it in every single podcast episode. Yeah. We literally bring it up every time. Is we're just like, it's unlike anything else you've read in such a refreshing way. And
thank
she takes
you so
you on
much.
This journey and it, the way you tie everything together at the end of that series specifically, I was just like, how?
I know.
How did you do this? This is incredible. Like everything made perfect sense. It all everything was like tied up except for the parts that you're not supposed to.
I know.
The little Easter eggs, which I'm like, I want to ask about that.
Yes. Like what Minya and her teeth.
Well, the multiverse you were talking about. Like I was like, oh, she's doing it. Yes. Oh, like I was so excited.
And, yeah, that was really fun when I got to that part where I got to sort of, you know, make those hints at the end, like knowing I don't want to, you know, if anybody hasn't read the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy, this is not going to pick up any of this, but I don't want them to feel like, what? Like, what's happening? I don't, what is this?
Yes.
So that was really fun to, you know, to tie that in there and to imagine that. Like I did think at the time too, that I would maybe possibly sooner than that have been like writing that book, but I have not, I haven't. And I hope to get to do that at some point, but who knows?
Hope to write the book that's like bringing the multiverse together a little bit. That was my question.
Like Endgame, tell us more. Tell us more.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's scary, it's big, and you know, I wouldn't want to, you know, embark on another like trilogy or even necessarily a duology, but it would be fun to at least play with that crossover a little bit. And you know, I like to think that there's and knowing that there's readers out there who would want to see that, but also, I don't know. I just wish I wrote faster and could just.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we haven't really talked a lot about Daughter of Smoke and Bone yet. We've been talking a lot about Strange to Dreamer trilogy. Yeah. It is fantastic. And so this was your first box set that you wrote, your first book that you were like, this was my first like real published work.
No, yes. Daughter of Smoke and Bone was my fourth book, actually.
Fourth. That's right, because there was The Lips Touch.
But it was my breakout book, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
A lot of people, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it's like a case study in marketing, right? Because when you see what happens with books that are marketed versus...
So tell me about the first four.
So the first three. So my first two were upper middle grade... you know, adventure fantasy about fairies. And that was a series, supposed to be a series. It was supposed to be like five books, but the publisher of Putnam at the time left and they sort of canceled everything and brought on, you know, all the editors were let go in the new publisher. Anyway, so that was, you know, that died a typical publishing death after two books. And then my next book was Lips Touch, which was, you know, three long short stories/novellas about kissing. And that was, you know, very serendipitous thing that had come out of my starting to do more writing exercises for fun in a like an online writing community at the time, like sort of height of the blog era back in like 2006, 2007, you know, around then. And really, you know, something I challenged myself to, I want to write more stories. Like I want to, you know, just write more for fun. After having worked on a novel, like my first novel, for like 2 years, I'm like, I just want to explore. And so that ended up being incredibly fruitful because those stories came out of it. And those stories were nominated or, you know, shortlisted for the National Book Award, which then at the time that I was writing Daughter of Smoke and Bone, you know, really made editors aware of me in a way that they would not have been if it hadn't been for the National Book Award. And so I just happened to then have a, you know, a much more commercial YA book, you know, in the works at a time, you know, at sort of like the apex of YA fantasy. So it was just really, really a lot of luck and timing with that.
We wanted to interrupt this podcast to tell you about a very important event that is happening at litjoycrate.com.
Oh my gosh, tell us.
I know. On February 21st, Lunacorns will get early access to the Vampire Academy Collector's Edition box set. So this box set is gorgeous. It has features we've never done before, which we always try and do something a little special. But this one is pretty epic. It drops on February 21st to Lunacorns, and it opens to the public on the 22nd. And if you're like, Alex, what's a Lunacorn? I can tell you. A Lunacorn is our nickname for our membership group. Our membership group is a group of readers just like you, but they come back to LitJoy and get extra perks. So they have early access. There's Lunacorn exclusive items. Mm-hmm. There's extra Lunacorn discounts. And we have a Facebook membership group where we do lives and we reveal product ahead of time, where we ask a bunch of questions or feedback on what product we want or they want us to do. So it's kind of just like this really cool book club, nerdy book club that we have at LitJoy. So make sure to check out our Lunacorns membership. It's titled Membership at the top of our website. And if you're just here for Vampire Academy, it opens to the public on the 22nd. So,
So excited for this.
Yes, me too. Talk to me about the inspiration for Daughter of Smoke and Bone. I love that you are dropped right into Prague. And this experience with Zuzana and Karu and, you know, like ex-boyfriend and like this whole fun like art school scene. And so I'm curious to know about how the real Prague inspired it and what kind of settings around the world have inspired some of the settings in your book.
Yeah. Well, so Daughter of Smoke and Bone, the opening of the book isn't the first thing I wrote, but the day that I started writing what became Daughter of Smoke and Bone is like hands down the most sort of memorable writing day of my life. And it was just one of those days I was trying to write something else. I've been trying to write something else, like a different novel after Lips Touch. So a different YA novel, which would have been my first one, but I call it my Ballerinas in Space book.
Yes.
It was sci-fi. Yeah. And it just wasn't, like, I couldn't get into it. Like, I couldn't sink my teeth in. The characters were just not coming to life. I was really bored with it. But I was, like, I've learned to be very stubborn or else, you know, you would just keep starting books and not finishing them. So I had gotten to a point of being like, oh my God, so bored. And I was like, I just need to write something else today. And so I sat down, no plan that I knew of, and started writing. And it's one of those things that I'm glad also that I have like the blog documentary of like what was really happening back then to sort of look at and see the context for all this, because it really in my memory feels like it just appeared, like all of this just like a Karu and Brimstone, and like they just, you know, came out of nowhere that day. And to an extent they did. I wrote, you know, like 30 pages or something. It is definitely not something that had ever happened to me before. These characters immediately alive, like, and the dynamic was there, and I was fascinated. And the main questions that ended up being, you know, Brimstone had a wishbone around his neck that Karu wasn't allowed to touch, and he was trading teeth. And the things that once I figured out why, like, became the essence of that story, those were there from that day. And I later, you know, had to, you know, look and realize that because of those writing exercises that I had been doing that had led to Lips Touch, that the seeds of all of this stuff was in prompt writing that I've been doing for months. You know, including the wishes and the teeth that came out of like just a prompt writing exercise one day about wishes that was on part of this like website that I used to co-run about for prompt writing. Mm-hmm. And so it was like all in there. And it just, that day, it just sort of all coalesced into this thing that became Daughter of Smoke and Bone. And then, you know, at a certain point, I was looking for an opening, like where do you imagine like taking the reader, kind of picking them up and like dropping them into the story? Like, where do you drop them? And Prague. Yeah. I had to figure out the setting too. Like, it wasn't my first thought. But Prague I had been to with my husband in like 2005, I think. We had gone there to research a graphic novel that we were thinking about doing. And it was, a vampire graphic novel. And we didn't end up doing that. But we had spent like 9 days in Prague looking at it as a setting. And so when I was, you know, writing this book, I just was like, oh, it's perfect, you know. And I even used some of this from that trip. Like, we had gone on a ghost tour, you know, and we had, you know, as you're walking around Prague for the rest of the trip, we would see the ghost tour actors were like hiding, waiting for their next group to come along so they could do their thing. And it was just really funny because you'd see this like ghost like leaning against a wall, like with their cell phone or whatever. Anyway, so that informed that, like made it into the story and a lot of other stuff. Yeah.
Well, and then also into A Night of Cake and Puppets. It also kind of made its little way in there, which was very magical realism. And it's kind of,
I wish that I could have gone back to Prague and like done an actual map for A Night of Cake and Puppets, you know, really like, you know, even planted some stuff. I don't know. That would have been fun, but it was not in the cards. I haven't been back, actually. I really want to go. Have you guys been?
No, not Prague. I mean, we've been to Europe a couple times, but I was going to ask you about that too, because, you know, we follow you just on Instagram, things like that. And it seems like travel is very important in your life, and was curious about like, how often do you travel and where and why? Like, do you travel to get inspiration? Is it just like part of your soul? Have you always traveled? Because I think you speak a few languages, right?
Yeah, I was a Navy brat, which is funny. I was speaking at a high school once, and I you know, said I was a Navy brat and realized that like nobody knew what I was talking about, and the civilian population didn't know what a Navy brat was, but it just means my dad was in the Navy. And yes. So I grew up, you know, moving around and to where he was stationed. And so we moved every few years, and we lived in Italy when I was, we moved there when I was 9 years old, in this beach town in southern Italy that could not have been a better, there could not be a better place to grow up. Like, it was just incredible. Like, between Rome and Naples, we were three blocks from this incredible beach, and it wasn't a touristy, it was touristy for Italians, like, but you didn't get very many international travelers. And, you know, it was like, this had been a port city for the Roman Empire, and had like this medieval, it was amazing. It was like the best place to be a kid. And then we moved to Belgium after that and lived in Brussels. And so both of those places where I started learning French and Italian, and then I studied French in college, but I'm not great at either of them, though I would love to go and spend more time and study. And we spent 3 months in Paris last year just because we were,
beautiful. Yeah.
It was awesome. We had gone, after not traveling for a while during COVID, we had gone on a short trip, like just a few, you know, 10 days or whatever, to Paris, which was still the longest we'd ever been in Paris. And it just, we just had this idea of doing it and figured out how, and it was amazing. But like, as soon as we got there, even though we knew we had 3 months, like, it was like, you saw the clock start to tick. We're like, this is going to go so fast.
Yes.
And it did.
Yeah.
So I would travel a lot more if I could. You know, it's just, I need to write faster, and I don't know, all those things. Now that I have a high schooler, it's harder to be flexible and travel.
Yeah, to pick up and
for
move.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
If she really wants to go to Japan, she's been spending Japan. And so that's got to be like our next goal. She's been like really, really amazingly diligent with her own, with learning Japanese on her own. So,
wow. That's impressive.
That's very cool.
I'm like amazed by it. Like, but you know, it's the different, you see the difference in, with a teenager, like a language that they, something that they're motivated to do on their own versus something you want them to do. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Her French that we made her do, and her Japanese that she's doing on her own, like, huge difference in engagement, you know?
Oh, for sure. I'm like, I'm just thinking about my own kids, and I'm all, I would have to pay them to like force them. Like, I don't know if I could force them, like, to be passionate.
They're still in elementary still. But
yes. Oh, almost.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
Getting there.
The things that they, you know, get into that you're, you know, that are completely theirs, that don't come from you. And it's like, huh, like, it's just so,
yes.
They're fascinating.
My son's so interesting. Like, he knows like all the facts about like basketball from like the 80s all the way till now. And I was born in the 80s. So, and I grew up with basketball, but I was just like, he's like, yeah, the dream team. Like, it's just so funny how he just, he wants to know everything. And he'll watch YouTube documentaries and videos and explain it. And like, it'll be the highlight reels. And he'll know about obscure NBA players on teams that didn't win any championships.
Yeah, I think that's one of the coolest things about parenting, is just seeing the things that they get
so
into that you never have. Yeah.
I'm just like, okay, live your dream. It's so true.
Amal, is there anywhere that you, it's like really up on your bucket list, so you're like, I will get there, but I haven't traveled there yet?
Like, everywhere, really, honestly. Like, traveling Europe a lot, but you know, it's, as you know, as you get older, I think it's the realization that of the limited time that there is starts to be more felt, which is sad, you know, because when I was in my 20s, it was always like, oh my god, just seemed like this endless expense of time. Of course I'll go everywhere. Now it's like, all right, got to make it happen, and you have to be choosy, because you know. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I haven't traveled in Asia very much. I've been to briefly Hong Kong, and I spent a month in Vietnam in my mid-20s. That was really cool because I worked for a travel guidebook publisher. I was an editor, but they were a not American company, so they actually gave good benefits.
Perfect.
You know, as not American companies are wont to do. So we had a month vacation, and another friend and I who worked there, we were able to go to Vietnam for a month before there was any, when it was like, before there was any Western anything there. It was like in the 90s, it was still in the 90s. And so there was like, it had just opened up. You could, you know, to tourism really. Mm-hmm. And there was like not even a single word of Western advertising in the entire country. And it was just so different, so cool to have gotten to go then. But I would love to travel in Asia more for sure, just Japan, but Thailand. And I'd love to go to the Philippines. So many places. Yeah, it's really hard to. And I'd love to go on a safari someday, though. I don't know if that one's going to happen. It's hard to say.
I know. The safaris are interesting. They're, it's definitely on my bucket list, but it's a whole experience because you have to get to Africa.
Yeah, and it's really pricey.
Yeah, and it's very pricey to get there, and it's pricey to go on a safari, but it's like, I don't know. It's one of those things where I'm like, it's probably worth it.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Because I'm such an animal person that I'm all, it's high up on the list for sure. Yeah.
Anywhere I travel, we're like hitting a zoo and the aquarium, like
everywhere we go. Because it's magical. There's something like otherworldly about an aquarium. Every time you're just like, it's incredible.
Yeah, my sister's a wildlife biologist, but she studies rattlesnakes for her specialty.
Fascinating.
But she's also a professor. But she travels a lot, and you know, partly for research, her own research, but partly she just knows so many scientists all over the world. And so she can go kind of anywhere and like hook up with other herpetologists who will like take her out in the field. And so she's actually going to Borneo this summer, which is somewhere I've always wanted to go. And there's a, you know, a biologist there who's going to take them into the jungle. And like, you know,
oh, cool.
This is the kind of tours you pay thousands of dollars as a civilian, right? To do that kind of thing. So she's really lucky that way.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What are you working on right now? Can you tell us anything?
You know, not really. It is an adult novel and it's like taken like way longer than it should have. It is, you know, near it's winding down now, but I've been saying that for a couple of years. So, if you follow me on Instagram, I call it Secret Book, and the publisher is just waiting to announce it until I turn in, a full draft. I've turned in drafts, but they were usually with my previous books, like, I'm very like, secretive. Like I don't have beta readers really until the very end. Like it's hard for me to give messy pages to anyone. I definitely like, by the time I turn in a book, usually it's like super polished. That doesn't mean that it doesn't still need editing or like, you know, whole narrative threads out, or it's not messy. Like it's polished in its way. But with this book, I definitely have, it's just been really complex. And, so there have been various drafts along the way that editors have seen, that the UK and the US editors. Given feedback on. But I'm just really, really can't wait to be able to turn in like a real, like what feels like a real polished draft for me. But that should be very soon. And then hopefully, you know, though I think the revisions will still take a little while, they'll actually be able to schedule and announce it. Yeah. So that'll be exciting.
Oh my goodness. So this is your first adult novel, right?
Yeah.
Do we get to know the genre?
It's fantasy.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm for in. Sure.
And I'll pull out.
It's unrelated to, you know, any of my other books, but it is adult fantasy.
Sorry, I feel I missed
so
that.
Excited. I'm all, we'll do a, like, let, so we'll just tell excited. You right now. We would love to do a special edition.
Yes.
We don't even need to read it. We're like, done.
Immediately. Are you finding it harder then to write an adult versus young adult?
You know, I don't think there's been a lot of reasons why this book has been hard. And I don't think that's why. I don't think it'll feel like that the writing will feel hugely different from my other writing. Maybe can be a little bit racier in places, possibly.
Okay.
But, you know, we'll see how it ends up in that regard. But I think that there's been a lot of reasons why it's been tricky. I mean, it's a complex book. It's got like, you know, a lot going on and the weaving, you know, the things that whole having faith that these elements are going to come together. It just, it like hasn't necessarily happened on the timeline that I would like that to happen. And there's been things I've rearranged in a more significant way than I've had to do in the past. Like, you know, take this plot thread and have that be the sort of like, you know, lead in plot before this, you know, so a lot more like reframing than I have had to do. Also, it was just a really, I've been working on it for like over 4 years now, and it's been an interesting 4 years in the world, hasn't it?
Yes, fair. Absolutely. You know.
And then also I think just there's been a lot of, there has definitely been a lot of like head stuff with it, not necessarily because it's adult, but it is a new editors to me. And it was sold on Pitch, which, you know, my last few books had been, but they were with an editor that I knew well. And so then you start doing that grass is always greener thing. Like, oh, I never want to like sell a book on Pitch again, because then you start thinking, is this what they thought they were going to get? You know, or is this the book that they're hoping, you know? And then, but then at the same time, you're like, recognize that it's just a huge luxury to be able to sell a book on Pitch and to have some money to live on when you're working on it. So,
yeah.
So, there is though, like, I guess there is no easy answer. But this one has just been, it's been hard. And I'm also like, I love it so much. And I can't wait to be able to talk about it in a more, yeah.
I'm so excited. Like,
so pumped. Yes.
I can't wait. So I'm like, but I will wait as many years as it takes.
Yes. We'll be for patient. Sure. Okay. I'm just going to ask one question for clarity purposes, because I feel like our listeners just want to know, or maybe it's just me. Maybe I just want to,
I don't know. I don't know the question yet.
Because we kind of talked about it, but I was like, wait, was that a maybe or a yes or no? Which is like, do you think the characters from Daughter of Smoke and Bone will ever meet the characters from Strange to Dreamer?
I mean, I think that something, I think I'll at least do something, whether like it's an actual novel. I don't know if that's something that, you know, will end up on my, you know, will end up happening, but I would at least love to write some, you know, some, like, think of it something as like fan fiction for my own world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
I wrote a story, actually, I don't know if you guys know this. I wrote on my Patreon, I wrote a story called It Would Be Stranger If There Weren't Dragons. And it's like a long short story about Fionn and Rusa.
Yeah.
So that was really fun to like revisit the world a little bit through those characters. And I'd like to do more things like that, you know, like smaller things. So I could imagine playing with
playing
that
room
at least, you know, and then possibly, you know, it's possible that it could be a novel, but
crack in the door.
Yeah.
And like, we'll just keep encouraging it. We'll keep peer pressuring.
Well, yeah, I wonder, like, you know, what would the timeline be? Like, you know, when in Karu's and Akiba's story would the astral, you know, reach, you know, their world? And I don't know.
Yes.
I'm like, these are questions I would have asked many times.
I know.
I'm so excited.
I'm just like, I love every little moment of it.
I'll take anything like, you write. So yes, this is great.
Thanks. Well, how about you? What are you guys working on that you're super excited about? Is there any secret projects that you can't talk about right now?
always.
Yes.
Yeah, we have a couple of, we've signed a few deals for special editions for 2025 that are going to be a pretty big deal. We were approached by the author publisher and asked if we would do an anniversary edition, as instead of the publisher doing an anniversary edition.
Oh.
And so that's something I'm incredibly excited for.
That's so cool.
It'd be really cool. It has kind of a mixed media element to it.
Were they willing to like just let you do it all, or did they have like their idea?
Yes.
They wanted
after the camera goes off, we can tell you more.
Yeah, yeah, we'll tell you all the details.
And then
I can imagine they're like, and we want it to be like this and this and this, and you know.
Yes. Yes. And then I'm always working on my fantasy novel on the side. It's always like I'll pick it up every now and then and add a little bit. But I've been doing that since before LitJoy. And then LitJoy really, it was a diverging moment in my life where I was like starting to write really heavily, and I could be a writer or I could do this company. And the company just felt like the right move. And so that's where I am. And then, yeah, that's kind of what's creatively. I'm starting a program where I can help people like on a healing journey. So that's kind of this weird thing I'm doing too.
That's amazing.
So
that's
great. Yeah. I just have like weird side things that I'm like, yes, I'll do that. And then I do.
That's important. I mean, you know, to have that, you know,
side quest.
Yes. To your life.
Yeah. Yeah. They're totally side quests where I'm going to learn how to do that thing.
And so, I was like, one day I'll write my children's book. I have like, I've always wanted to write like a picture book. They are just little
moments of poetry for me. I just love collecting them. I feel like hundreds of picture books.
Certainly. So, you know, it's funny. Clementine just hit her like, I am a teenager now. Can we please get all this stuff out of my room?
Oh, and,
so just like right after New Year's, and she had two towers, like 10-foot towers of IKEA bookcases in her room that were just packed with, like, we had put a lot of the picture books up, but you can fit, oh my God, you can fit so much in bookcases.
I know.
So now they're like, the whole rest of the house is somehow filled with what was on her bookcases. I don't know. So it was like this, the picture books that I had collected, like even before we even had a kid, and like even before, yes. like long before I was even thinking about it. And it's crazy how much they've changed in my adult life. Like picture books
yes.
from, I was like taking them out, and these like storybooks, these long fairy tales with like lots of text, and not from like yes. my childhood, but even from the 90s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so different now.
Now they're like much yeah. more simple. My yeah. favorite storybook author always growing up was Mercer Mayer.
Oh my God, I love Mercer Mayer. And you never, like, no one knows it. You never see him.
I know. His little critter books are like
the cutest.
My favorite.
Yeah, one of my favorite childhood books was a Mercer Mayer book. It was called Liza Lou.
Yes.
And yeah, I just looked him up sometime in the last year because I was like, whatever happened to Mercer Mayer, you know?
Yeah.
I know. I liked Babar for a long time. I remember like those picture books. My dad hated it. And so he refused to read it to me. So it's like I taught myself to read because I was like, fine, I'll read it. And then my next one was anything Roald Dahl wrote. I love the little bit of whimsical mixed with a little bit macabre.
It's very, like, always a dark element.
A little darkness, for sure.
That was me. Okay, well, I feel like I want to wrap up asking you a couple questions we love to ask. When we bring on different guests,
are these going to be the ones, the kind of questions that make my mind go blank?
We'll just go to the next one. We'll just skip right over it.
Okay, so this is probably the hardest question, but it's always one of my favorites, which is, if you could sit down to have coffee or tea with any author, living or deceased, who would you choose and why?
Yeah, this is funny. It is one that I actually tried to think about for a few minutes before we got on. And I'm such like a awkward dork that like nobody living, like I feel like I'm just too unless it's somebody in like the YA or kidlit community that, you know, they're approachable like anybody else, the kind of people that I would I don't know, like I couldn't really think of anything. I was thinking of dumb stuff like Shakespeare, just to settle the mystery of like, if you know,
is he
like, is he a guy, was he like a one person, did he really write these, you know, that sort of thing. But that just felt kind of like a cheat because I'm not, you know, I haven't read Shakespeare.
No, it doesn't have to be poetic. It really doesn't. Don't let teenage Lainey discount that.
Yeah,
it's answer.
Like, I want to like uncover some dirt. Like, who are the historical authors?
100%.
I couldn't.
I would absolutely do tea. Like tea with
Shakespeare.
Like tea for tea. You know, like because you're getting tea on. I'm like, you're not drinking coffee, drinking tea. We'll get there, Alex.
You're drinking something.
There's something there. It's true. I think Shakespeare would be a brilliant one to like go back and be like, who are you? Are you like Banksy, but with plays? Like, is it a
movie? This isn't like me being like, oh, Shakespeare, so that I can later. Yeah, I was like, I just want to know. Like, no.
Like, tell me everything. Totally.
Are you really one? Yeah. Were you really one person? Or is this some big literary hoax? Like, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yes. Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, so what are you reading right now then?
Yeah, actually, so this one I'm prepared for. So I just started Nettle and Bone.
It's on my list.
Won the Hugo this year. Like, I'm only a couple chapters in, but it's great. But then I wanted to, so I just finished, you guys know this duology?
Yes, I have seen it. I have not started it.
So I just finished the second one. I love them. They're so good. So it's a complete duology now by E.K. Ead. And they're sort of set in this Mediterranean, like sort of Amalfi Coast feeling fantasy world. I love the romance in them so much. Like, it just feels so sort of like vulnerable and sweet and open and real. And so I really, really love those. So Little Thieves by Margaret Owen. I really love Little Thieves series by Margaret Owen and her other series, which is the Merciful Crow. This Vicious Grace and This Cursed Light by Emily Feed.
Perfect.
And
thank you so much.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes as well and link to those. But those are Those are all on my like to read list. So whenever I hear someone recommending books, I'm like, that's moving up.
Yep.
So
I bump it right up. Is there a book that you, this is the last question. Do you have books that you recommend to everyone? Like for me, it's Strange the Dreamer. I'm always like, you should read Strange the Dreamer.
Thank you so much. That means so much. You know, somebody that I call back to a lot is Frances Harding. She's a British. She writes like literary middle grade, but not literary. I don't know how to describe it. It's the kind of middle grade that, you know, you can read as an adult. And it only feels middle grade and that the characters are young. And I don't know. Like, she wrote a book called The Lie Tree that won like the Costa Award like 6 or 7 years ago, I think. But all of her books are all standalone. And they're all crazy imaginative and beautifully written. And she's just somebody who, like, I know, you know, a lot of people who love her, but also I don't, but I think a lot of people might not. Have tried.
I feel like middle grade gets missed a lot.
Middle grade is so, I feel like it's more consistent or like more reliable than YA in a way. Like, there's a lot of, like, there's been gluts of YA that have come out at certain times where like there's more, I don't know, I'm not to criticize anything, but like for me, that sort of category of like literary middle grade is like so reliable.
Yeah, we have a few middle grades that live forever on our favorites list. Like, The Wishing Tree and Echo and Wonder. It's a genre that ought not to be skipped over, feel like.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I love those recommendations.
It can be really, like, some of these books, like hers, are absolutely just as sophisticated as any adult novel. It just that, you know, a really smart 10-year-old could read them too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take those to my, we'll take them to our kids because my son and Kelly's daughter are both sixth graders and they're devouring Percy Jackson right now.
Oh my gosh. Like, yes.
They read the graphic novels and now my son's reading the full novels. And that's the first time I've seen him light up since, I don't know, Captain Underpants. And so I'm all, it is time.
At 14, you know, she read them like, you know, some years ago, but now that watching the show, she's just so excited about it in a way that you can only have been, you know, if you read them at that age.
Yes. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Oh, and the new show's so good too.
I know.
Wow, so it really is.
Just a little plug for that.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed it.
Amazing. Well, Lainey, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to see you guys.
And whenever you wrap up your book you're working on, we'll read it. I mean, I'm like, I will immediately email Jane and be like, any day that there is an ARC available, if that ever happens.
I just cannot wait. Like, I
know.
I told this to a writer friend a long time ago that there was this like visualization, like when you're like in the trenches, you're just like so ready to be done with the book that you imagine like your future self holding the finished book and you know that it's going to happen, but just like picturing that like helps in some ways. So I'm like, I'm so ready to have like a finished book and to be able to, give it to people to read.
I'm like, absolutely. We're so ready to receive it.
Whenever it comes out, we'll read it and then we'll have you back on and we'll do like a little book club about it. It'd be so fun.
Guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Thank you, Lainey.
All right, reader, thank you for tuning in as we chatted with Lainey Taylor. We really appreciate you rating and reviewing us so that we can keep doing these amazing interviews.
And like a good book, recommend us to your friends.